From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Over the past couple of years, as the foreclosure crisis has grown, NPR has been following the efforts of a pretty colorful housing advocate. His name is Bruce Marks, and he heads up the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, NACA. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, lately Marks has been on tour, where he says he's helped bring down loan payments for nearly 100,000 homeowners.
Bruce Marks only half-jokingly calls himself a non-violent bank terrorist. Back last winter, we did a story on Marks when he led several hundred people down the driveway and up to the mansion of a house where John Mack lives. Mack is the CEO of Morgan Stanley.
It's so outrageous. While Americans are losing their homes by the millions, he's living here in his beautiful house.
Marks has protested plenty of other executives who he says are not doing enough to avoid foreclosures. He's even posted on his website their photos and home phone numbers. Morgan Stanley said it's working with Marks's group. And for Marks, it's not just about the bullhorns. For 20 years, he's run a nonprofit that makes affordable home loans. And over the past year, he's doubled his staff and now has 1,200 employees nationwide.
If you have any questions, please feel free to locate your team.
We caught up with Marks at a very different sort of event in San Francisco. Lately, Marks has been running a foreclosure help roadshow. He calls it the Save the Dream Tour. His group at NACA rents out a stadium for several days, and a ton of people show up.
In Los Angeles, we had over 50,000 people there. Then in Phoenix, over 40,000 people. Vegas, over 45,000 people.
Housing counselors are set up at hundreds of tables across the floor of the stadium. Homeowners are told to bring their loan documents, W-2s, and other paperwork. Through his protests, Marks has pressured many of the major banks and other so-called loan servicing companies to sign agreements to work with him, and so they send representatives here too. And Mark says over the past year, his group's been able to renegotiate loans and get payments lowered for more than 90,000 homeowners.
I was in Las Vegas last weekend, and I finished up here today.
62-year-old Bernice Jackson is from Los Angeles. She drove hundreds of miles to come to these events. Jackson's husband is retired, and they're on a fixed income. She says a mortgage broker lied to them, and she got into a loan that she just couldn't afford.
Oh, man, I had a very high interest rate, and through NACA and the help of the servicers, I got the note reduced to 2%. So my note went from almost $4,000 a month to $1,600 a month. Yes, I'm very excited, very happy.
Now, that may sound too good to be true, but Marks's group pushes the banks to try to get a new payment that the homeowner can really afford. And that can make sense for the banks or the investors who own the loans. And actually, a very big-time investor has shown up here at this event.
Yeah, it's actually pretty unbelievable. Want to come see what they're doing and how they're doing it, and it's pretty impressive.
Scott Simon is a managing director for PIMCO. It's an investment firm that manages some $200 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. That makes him one of the biggest mortgage investors in the entire world. And here he is, standing in the midst of thousands of people looking to pay investors like him less money, and he thinks that's a good idea. In fact, he'd actually like to see more people getting their principal reduced. That's the amount that they owe. He says that too many people are upside down, owing way more than their house is worth, and that doesn't give them much of an incentive to keep their house.
Well, I think that is right, because you're going to potentially have as many as 7 million people go into foreclosure unless they're helped over the next 3 years. So, you know, you're talking about 10% of households. You know, foreclosure is almost always the absolute worst thing can happen. It's bad for the homeowner. It's bad for the neighborhood. It's bad for the investors. It's bad for the system.
Simon would like to see more workouts where investors like him forgive a chunk of principal so that the loan can be refinanced at a market rate and the borrower isn't upside down anymore. Other investors have resisted these efforts. They think too many homeowners won't make even the lower payments, so they'll get foreclosed on anyway. But Bruce Marks estimates that about 75% of the homeowners that NACA gets a loan modification for keep making their payments. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Remember those days when shrimp cocktails were so skimpy and you'd only get 5 or 6 in a glass? Well, now you can enjoy as many shrimp as you want.
Endless shrimp at Red Lobster, the only time of year to enjoy all the...
The U.S. now consumes more shrimp per capita than any other seafood. But about 90% of that shrimp comes from farms overseas. So how do American shrimpers stay in business? Weekend Edition producer Thomas Pierce joins us. He recently returned from a trip on a shrimp boat off the coast of South Carolina. Hi there, Thomas.
Hi, Jackie.
You know, how much shrimp are we talking about? How much is the American market compared to everything else?
The American market is pretty small compared to the what we're bringing in imports. We brought in about 1.2 billion pounds of shrimp last year, and the American market is just a quarter of that. So even if you're living down in the Gulf, if you order those shrimp and grits, you're probably going to find imported shrimp on the plate.
So it's got to be a pretty hard way to make a living.
It's pretty hard. They're not making nearly as much money as they used to. And look, I'm from South Carolina, and I was pretty interested in this. So I went down to Shem Creek, which is Charleston, South Carolina, and it's a longtime hub for shrimpers, to see who's left and how they're making it. And that's where I met Wayne Magwood. He's the owner of a market there. It's been open for 40 years. He calls himself the public relations officer for South Carolina shrimp. And he took me out on his trawler, The Winds of Fortune.
Hey, good morning, Captain. We think you're ETA to the Cooper Bridges.
So it's 5 a.m. and we've just left the dock. Wayne Magwood leans back in his captain's chair, radio in his hand. He's wearing two flannel shirts because it's chilly out this morning. There's salt on the windows, and that obscures what is already a dark view. Tiny lights twinkling out ahead.
That's my brother's boat he just left up there.
He navigates in the dark, chatting with other captains on the radio about the temperature, the size of the waves, and yesterday's rain.
My damn rain jacket filled up with water with my phone in it. She went bloop, 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 and that was it.
They also talk about where they might go today, north or south along the coast of Charleston.
In the old days, they didn't share information much, you know, it was kind of cutthroat. Everybody was out for themselves, but now there's not many of us left, so we pretty well work together.
Wayne knows about the old days. He's a third-generation shrimper.
Been on shrimp boat all my life, since I was 4 years old. Me and my brother and my dad, and then when I graduated from high school, we started running the boats. My brother and I, we take turns being captain. Eventually, my dad bought another boat, and so my brother had one, I had one, and he bought another one. Dad had one, two brothers, and then my little brother came along, and he bought another
basically,
one.
Basically, every male Magwood had a boat back then. Up until the late 80s, you might have seen 60 shrimp trawlers operating out of Shem Creek. Today, he says there are more like 6. We're north of Charleston now, just 3 miles offshore. The sun's still not up, but it's time to put out the nets. The crew works in silence, cigarettes dangling from their lips as they use a giant winch to lower 45-foot outriggers on either side of the boat. There's 29-year-old Vinny Vieira, 18-year-old Vasa Tarvi, and John Zillman, the newest crew member. He's 36. They swing two ancient-looking doors out over the water.
Those are called the otter boards, and it rides right on the bottom and it spreads the net open. This chain in front of the net is called a tickler chain, like it tickles the shrimp, I guess, makes them jump up off the bottom, out the mud, and into the net.
What happens next happens fast. A line pops, and one of the otter boards falls into the waves. The crew scrambles to fix the problem. John Zillman accidentally steps back into the net as it's going over the side of the boat. A chain tightens around his ankle, nearly dragging him over the side. Vinny and Vasa hold on to him, squeezing his foot out of his boot.
Get out! Get the foot out of there!
Once he's out, he sits to massage his ankle.
Did it hurt your ankle?
No, I'm good. Could have carried you over the side.
They fix the line and get the nets out, all 120 feet of them. The crew then files back into the deckhouse to make eggs and grits on a small stove. Their plates slide as they eat in a cloud of cigarette smoke. Then they watch some of a movie, Hellboy 2, before passing out in bunks, boots still on their feet. The next 3 hours are a waiting game. Wayne can't help but recall their best days.
One day, I think it was about 5 years ago, they opened shrimp season and the shrimp were big. First day, we caught 9,000 pounds. And they were all big shrimp. Boat made $27,000 that day, one day. That was the best haul we ever made. Beautiful, beautiful day.
Yesterday, he caught more like 600 pounds of large and medium-sized white shrimp, which brought in about $1,500. That gets divided among the boat crew and the dock crew, minus the cost of fuel. It's not that white shrimp population is down from 5 years ago. In fact, according to the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, if anything, there might be more now because of the milder winters. It boils down to being in the right place at the right time. And as for today, we find out 3 hours later. sea life spills onto the deck, a huge pile heaving like a beating heart. Stingrays, flounder, a baby shark, croakers, minnows, and of course, shrimp.
Not as pretty as I wanted to be, but it's at least 200 pounds. Big ones, maybe 250 pounds. Big ones.
Now comes the job of sorting through it all. The guys sit on small stools picking out the shrimp, which go in buckets. The rest of it, some of it alive and some not, gets swept overboard. A free meal for the seagulls and porpoises that follow the boat like band groupies. Vinny Vieira is Wayne Magwood's stepson, and he's been shrimping for 11 years now, 6 days a week.
You make good money at it sometimes.
You make good money sometimes?
Yeah. Some years are better than other years, but, you know, we make a living doing it. Wayne put 4 kids through college, and I got 2 children myself, so, I mean, we're surviving, you know?
Each crew member gets a 10% cut, he says, and that translates to anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000 a year.
Either ignorant or stubborn, I don't know which. We're just hoping it'll turn around. If we can hang there long enough, the price will go up with everything being going local. Most of your shrimpers are selling to restaurants.
Wayne advertises a list of the Charleston restaurants that serve his shrimp on a chalkboard back at his market. These restaurants, he says, help keep shrimpers in business. And promoting those relationships is the job of the South Carolina Shrimpers Association. Wayne Magwood is the president of the organization this year.
Shrimpers had a bad rap, bad PR, so we try to do some good PR. You know, get out to the public that we're not raping the ocean. We're just out there to make a living, trying to provide a resource for the community.
Part of Wayne's PR strategy means taking people out on his boat, from school kids and community leaders to people like Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel and Mike Rowe from the Discovery Channel show Dirty Jobs. He'll take anyone if it helps get the word out about ocean-caught shrimp.
Yeah, I think the word's getting out. It's slow, but it's getting out there. Hopefully it'll get out and we'll be able to survive. And hopefully we get some young blood in this industry because not many of us left.
And that's our producer, Thomas Pierce, with that story. And he joins me in the studio now. Thomas, I love this. You've got a bumper sticker that says, "Friends don't let friends eat imported shrimp."
I do. These have been around for a couple of years. They're not just in South Carolina, but you do see them on bumpers all over the state. The South Carolina Shrimpers Association hand these out, and it kind of encapsulates this marketing campaign they've got going on.
Does it work?
Captain Magwood says he's noticed improvement. When we got back to the dock, there were, in fact, a couple of regular customers waiting with empty coolers. I will add, though, that Captain Magwood is doing better than many others because he's been around for a long time and he's got this market. Most shrimpers don't have their own markets. He's got deep ties to this area. So he even remarked that if things get even worse, he could be the last one standing.
Well, you can see a photo gallery of a day on the Winds of Fortune shrimp trawler by coming to NPR.org. And Thomas, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Jackie.
And we're joined now by NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, thanks for being with us. And we asked Mr. Axelrod about that Associated Press report that the number of jobs created or saved by the stimulus bill has been vastly inflated. He said AP was, quote, extrapolating from a small piece of information. We believe we're going to hit our goal, which was to create several million jobs. But the bigger goal is to get the economy growing again. So this week we saw that growth numbers were in a positive direction for the first time since last year. How do you think this issue is going to play out?
Well, on this Halloween, Scott, let me say it's a trick-or-treat, good news, bad news situation. I'd say the good news is this week we heard there's a 3.5% growth in the gross domestic product in the third quarter of the year, which marked an apparent end to the recession. Obviously, it's been the longest recession our nation's seen since World War II. That's good news. The bad news is we have a very high persistent unemployment rate, 9.8% at the moment. And you think about the spending that has been put into the stimulus package. Everyone's aware of the astronomical levels of debt that the government's incurring. So politically, then, it's become a tricky deal because the test of the stimulus now has become one item alone, job creation. And I think that when you what you heard from David Axelrod is saying, wait a second, you've got to look at the fact that the stimulus spending has helped to, I'm quoting from your interview, helped to stem the flow, to stem the momentum of this recession. So he's trying to broaden that picture for the way that voters, especially in New Jersey or Virginia this coming week,
to the polls on Tuesday,
will think about what's going on with stimulus spending. But I'm just back from Colorado, and they're in Governor Ritter's state, 7% unemployment, and they're talking about jobs and the stimulus as having played an important role in keeping the state afloat. Governor Schwarzenegger was at the White House for this announcement on stimulus spending, and he said, coming from California state with 12% unemployment, tremendous help coming from the stimulus.
Yes.
New York Times this morning, though, has an interesting story in which it says that really, people should think about this stimulus package more in terms of teachers. They said that 325,000 of the 640,000 jobs being created or saved, claimed by the White House, only 80,000, 325,000 of those jobs were teachers, only 80,000 in construction. So I think what you're seeing here is a conversation about what is the impact and how will Republicans play it versus how Democrats play it. And the Republicans are saying it's just about jobs, and the White House has not kept their pledge of 8% unemployment or less. And the White House is saying it would have been worse if it not for the spending that's already in place.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
Jonathan Safran Foer probably won't lament the news out of Iceland this past week. At midnight, the griddle masters at Reykjavik's three McDonald's outlets served up the last Big Macs. The golden arches will no longer illuminate the skyline of the island's capital. The collapse of Iceland's currency, the krona, drove up the price of a Big Mac to $6.36, by far the most expensive Big Mac in the world. And the problem began with
meat, cheese, chicken, bread, and so on.
That's what John Ogmundsson had to import into Iceland. He's the managing director of the McDonald's franchise in Iceland, and everything he sold, every chicken nugget, every Happy Meal, every McRib, had to be flown in.
I have to fly all salads and onion twice a week to Iceland. And since petrol prices also has risen, and the Icelandic krona has collapsed, all this kind of cost, of course, has more than doubled.
Iceland now joins Bosnia, Albania, and the Vatican as one of the few places in Europe without McDonald's. But there is good news for Icelanders jonesing for a late-night grease fest. John Ogmundsson has other plans.
I'm opening a new local chain that I have made myself, opening three restaurants called Metro. And we will sell similar product, but improved. And with all meat and cheese and everything will be Icelandic made.